Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast, bringing you daily conversations, arguments, and shouting matches from a libertarian perspective with some of the smartest people on the planet and me. Subscribe, rate, and review us at iTunes. Check us out at SoundCloud. And, of course, go to Reason.com to check out everything Reason is writing, thinking, and putting out on audio and video. Today's guests on the podcast are Reason Magazine's editor-in-chief, Catherine Mangu Ward, and the Weekly Standard's Andrew Ferguson, who's also written for Reason over the years, as well as a lot of other places. Thanks for coming, Catherine and Andy.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. The election is less than 2 weeks away, and things seem to be sliding in Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party's direction. Let's assume, at least for the start of conversation, that Hillary wins and the Dems take the Senate, too, which seems to be the scenario more and more people are playing out or want to happen, I guess. From a libertarian perspective, one that cherishes the Reason mantra of free minds and free markets, how bad is a Hillary win with a Democratic Senate put in place? How bad is that going to be? Catherine, what do you think?
It's going to be bad. I mean, at this point, I think we've all lost our perspective on what bad even means anymore. When we're like, okay, well, the upside is the likelihood of catastrophic nuclear war because of a personal grudge is going to be dramatically diminished. Like, Nothing makes sense anymore. So I think that's where we are. My view on Hillary has always been that she is a classic statist. And it just seems to me that particularly with the Senate in her pocket, she is going to make new rules about everything that we are going to have to follow. And that's going to suck.
What's a specific that you would worry about? I mean, because back in the 90s, she was talking a lot about daycare and, we need to up. Yeah, I mean, she wasn't even in an elected office, but she was talking about how, daycare is just dangerously shitty. We're raising the super predators because we're letting our aunts and uncles and, drunken grandparents raise our kids. Is it stuff like that? Or is she going to be making rules so that her Wall Street buddies get even richer?
Both, all of the above. That's why I say statist and not, welfare statist or crony capitalist or whatever. I think any rule that can be made that she sees as a marginal improvement on what people do when left to their own devices, she will try to make it. There is nothing in her philosophy that restrains her from that.
Yeah.
And she'll be doing it for our own good,
it's going to be really generous of her to do that.
So there's no chance that we're going to get the private WikiLeaks Hillary, which, I have to say, and Andy, I don't know where you are on the kind of trans, hemispheric free trade zone where Brazilians can come and leave here whenever they want. And they can go through customs in their skinny bikinis and all of that kind of stuff. But some of the stuff she was talking about in private on the WikiLeaks dumps, I was kind of like, shit, I could live in that world, hemispheric free trade zone.
I thought the same thing. She's a much more attractive person when no one's listening to her. But the free trade thing, I would agree with her instincts are probably in that direction. But if she does have a Democratic Senate, it's a moot point because they're not going to let her, especially given what's happened in this election, they're not going to let her revive any kind of large free trade deal. The real problem that I see with her is has to do with foreign policy. And this you see both in her public statements and but especially in these talks to Goldman Sachs and others. She's a neocon without the con part. I mean, she has this kind of unrestrained view of it's kind of sort of a Kennedy liberal view of America, American power, going anywhere, paying any price, bearing any burden.
Last time I checked, John F. Kennedy, he managed to sneak out of that deal pretty quickly, right? Almost after saying it.
He offended Ted Cruz's father, and that's one thing you don't do, piss somebody off like that. Anyway, what that is basically is kind of a half-assed internationalism which gives you a license to talk really, really big.
Yeah.
Bush had it. The W. Bush had it. You know, you talk really big, and then when the shit starts to fly, it's like, oh man, what am I doing here? And just as in Vietnam, which is a classic kind of liberal internationalist adventure, you know, you don't do one thing or the other. You just kind of get bogged down while a bunch of people get killed. And I think that's the kind of thing that because she'll have a Democratic Senate and all of her better instincts will be stifled by that, she's going to exert herself on the foreign policy front, and that's the kind of thing that she's going to like.
Let's stop for a moment and note, remind people that Andrew Ferguson, author of a series of excellent books, buy them all, read them all, memorize them all, because when Hillary becomes president, she's going to burn all the books, and it's going to be like Fahrenheit 451. But that you work at the Weekly Standard, the publication that is probably more closely identified with neoconservative foreign policy than any other publication. And you're worried about Hillary being an unrestrained internationalist hawk.
Well, not unrestrained. See, this is, I think unrestrained I could live with. You know, the sort of Curtis LeMay, blow them all down, pave it over, turn it into a parking lot, put Disneyland in the middle. You know, if as long as you're all in, you're going to be a better, safer prospect than if you're somebody who's like, oh, yeah, I really think we ought to do this. And then, wait a minute, people are getting hurt. And then you're sort of like the cow that Abraham Lincoln talked about who gets caught on the fence and you can't kick forward and you can't kick backward. And so that's, you know, that's where Vietnam comes from. That's where Iraq comes from.
Can I put on my Megyn Kelly for a second and say, so you're calling Hillary Clinton a cow, Andy Ferguson? Why are you obsessed with sex?
I wouldn't insult cows in that way. I'm an animal lover.
So is she ultimately preferable to Trump? And let's, you know, pretend that we're just talking amongst ourselves and we're not recording this for an ever large, ever growing Reason podcast audience. And subscribe at iTunes, please. Make it even bigger. I've talked with a lot of libertarian types and conservative types as well, Republicans, who say, you know what, deep down, like, you know, yeah, Hillary is awful. I mean, she is in many ways, she is like the last gasp of the worst elements of the 1990s, which had a lot of good things going for it, a lot of bad things going for it. But she's the last gasp of the worst of that, but she's better than Trump. Catherine, are you buying that? Or is that actually, are you holding out hope? And of course, we want Gary Johnson to win and maybe create a coalition government with Jill Stein, who seems to be right about almost everything that matters. But, I mean, is a Hillary presidency, no matter how bad it is it ultimately preferable to Trump?
I don't know. I think with Hillary, we have the same problem that we had really badly with Obama 8 years ago, where all the awful things that she does, her supporters say, oh, she's just doing that to win the votes, but I know she agrees with me in her heart. And you know, these WikiLeaks emails don't help with that, because clearly she is saying some things just to win the voters, and it's not what she believes in her heart. But you know, I think this hopefulness around her being not too terribly awful or whatever it is, because she's lying to us about what she really believes. You know, that's not.
That's really reassuring.
Yeah,
thank God she's a liar.
Yeah, no, that's really kind of a step forward in modern American politics. Andy, what about you? Do you think that Trump is just like catastrophic from word go?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans who are making that argument are wrong. I couldn't vote for Trump at all. I mean, just on aesthetic grounds alone.
What do you mean by that? You're just a classist.
He's too disgusting. Yeah.
He's like a tawdry, you know, it's sad too, because he's like second or third generation money, but he acts, you know, he's worse than a lottery winner, right? When it comes to kind of these tawdry displays of wealth and power.
Maybe it's something about growing up in Queens. I don't know, but he's just, it's really, although Catherine and I have a very dear friend, David Skinner, who grew up in Queens, and he's nothing like Donald Trump. But Anyway, I think these Republicans who are saying
is it too late for him to get into the race? Because, I mean, we do have almost 2 weeks, so anything can happen.
Yeah, I'd vote for him on aesthetic grounds. So the thing is about this argument the Republicans are making for Hillary, when the few who are, is we're much more of a parliamentary system than any of us want to admit. Mm-hmm. That is, you don't elect a person to be the chief executive. You really elect a shadow government that then comes in
And now, Andy, you know, we had discussed this ahead of time. We're not going into the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Bilderberger stuff, no matter how much you believe it. But so
So I can't go on with that.
What shadow government are we? Or we're electing a
the
party.
The people who are going to be. Yeah, you're electing a party. You're all the apparatchiks, where a lot of the really serious decisions of government get made. You know, most of them never rise to the level of the chief executive. And to my way of thinking, and as sort of a, I guess I'd say a right-wing libertarian or libertarian right-winger, the decisions made by sort of the average Republican apparatchik would be much more to my liking at, say, the Department of Education or OSHA or somewhere, than a left-wing apparatchik would be. And so we are actually going to be electing, you know, what is it, 8,000 people or something.
So
who
that's
are going
an
to be
argument
dictating our lives.
Is that an argument for Trump? Because bring in, you know, with he obviously, he may not even move to Washington. I could see him just being like, you know, I can just do it on the weekends while I'm running Trump TV or something.
Right. Or if he does move to Washington, he'll stay in his hotel.
Yeah.
In that big tower. But anyway, so I think I'm just sort of countering this, what I think is kind of a silly argument that Republicans make, that Hillary, from a Republican point of view, is preferable to Trump. I think that's just crazy.
So what about, you know, I mean, I'm sure Hillary will be catastrophically worse on the, you know, questions of things like the business regulations and foreign policy that both of you were talking about. I'm also confident that we'll route around a lot of that pretty well, because do either of you share my sense that this, you know, this is kind of the last election of the 20th century? I mean, you know, and give them credit. I was watching somebody was talking yesterday about how, you know, Hillary and Trump are both older than Reagan was in 1980 when he was running for president. And they seem a lot younger than he was back then. I mean, they have a lot of vitality and a lot of energy. And as somebody who is a late baby boomer and is getting really fucking old, I want to believe that, you know, 70 is the new 40 or something. But like this is a way station, right? I mean, this is a holding tank election. Nobody really thinks Hillary is going to be able to start a bold new initiative, or Trump will last more than one term. So is it kind of like, you know, after this election, maybe, or I guess maybe throw it out here as a kind of libertarian hope, a small libertarian hope, that both of these people are so unpopular, the parties they represent are unpopular, Democrats and Republicans are at or near historic lows in terms of voter identification, that will be like, okay, yeah, you can have the federal government, and we are just going to ignore you as much as possible and get on with real life. And then maybe in 2020, we can find somebody who, a government that would actually be worthy of the 21st century, as opposed to these blowhards from the past.
We thought we were done with that already, though, right? Yeah. I mean, Andrew Sullivan did that cover story in The Atlantic about Obama. That was the reason Barack Obama is great and important, is because for at long last, we're going to stop refighting the boomers' wars. And, you know, I guess you could draw different lessons from his presidency, but I don't think what happened in the last 8 years was that we left the morass that the boomers created behind. You know, I don't see how this sort of post-boomer politician saved us from that. And I don't see any particular reason to think that Trump would be generationally typical or century typical at all. He could do anything.
I want to say that. You know, I also in 2000 I boldly pronounced that was the last election of the 20th century. So this is
I'm going to keep saying it.
Sense, of course, you were right.
But. Yeah, I'm going. Yeah, but in another more profound sense, obviously, I was way off. So. Let's talk about Gary Johnson. Catherine, what do you think about Gary Johnson? What has he done right and what has he done wrong? And is he a credit to his ideological race of libertarians?
You know, I got this email in my inbox yesterday from Bill Weld saying, people are saying I endorsed or I denounced Trump and endorsed Hillary, and I just want to clarify that that's not true. So it seems like maybe the campaign's not going super smoothly. you know, it's I like Gary Johnson. I think people are asking far too much of him in a time when they themselves have delivered complete and utter garbage. I mean, you know, all of these Republicans who are saying, oh, I would have voted for Libertarian, but Gary Johnson isn't perfect. Yeah. In
Gary
some
Johnson
way.
Is in fact a libertarian, so yeah, that
Gary
categorically rules him out. Yeah,
so that's a problem. Or he's not libertarian enough. But of mm-hmm. course, if the libertarians had floated a total purist, they would have said, "Look at this crazy yeah. ball of beans." There was no way for him to win the election, and there was also no way for him to win the kind of chattering class right. positioning game. That said, when you're sending out emails 2 weeks before the election clarifying that you didn't endorse one of your opponents, the campaign is not being run smoothly.
What are you speaking from as the mouthpiece of you know, the failed Bush presidency, the Weekly Standard? you know, the utter destruction of entire regions of the Middle East and Central Asia. And
hey, that wasn't me.
Well, I don't know. Oh, what are
that
you?
That was me.
Are,
I yeah. was there then.
Yeah, right. she was there. She was okay. there yeah. more
well,
of that
we'll,
time
we'll
than I was.
We'll get to that. But I mean, are you claiming that you only write the puns and the lyrics in the back or the parodies? But what do you like Gary Johnson, or do you think he has moved the ball forward in terms of kind of, if not, you know, the Libertarian Party per se, libertarian sensibilities, or has he soiled the brand?
Well, I'm speaking kind of disinterestedly because I agree that, you know, there wasn't going to be anything happening with the Libertarians this time around or next time around or probably time around after that. So I just kind of observe it clinically, and I mean, it just seems to me that libertarians were in the same position that Republicans, in that here's this golden opportunity you're for lots of different reasons in different parties, obviously, but you've got a beautiful opportunity to either advance the brand or actually win. I don't think libertarians had that, but the Republicans could have won. And instead they end up with a buffoon at the top of the ticket, and I think that's I'm sure Gary Johnson's a very nice person, but he comes off as a buffoon. And I think he's, as Catherine says, the chattering class really has him pegged now as a buffoon. And whether that's fair or not, that just hurts the brand. You know, it becomes somebody, you know, people are, oh, that's that party that had that guy who didn't know anything about Aleppo, you know. And that's really, that's kind of tough to compensate for.
For the buffoon factor, for me, it was the holding his tongue between his teeth while talking to an NBC reporter. The Aleppo stuff, you know, I could take or leave, but I will stick up for Gary Johnson. You know, the one thing that we, you know, he seems to be being held to various impossible standards, where he either should be winning because God knows Trump is terrible and Hillary Clinton is worse than Satan. So why isn't Gary Johnson getting 40% or something, you know, which he obviously couldn't do. And he is, you know, he's tripling or, you know, by a you know, 500 or 1,000%. I have no math skills whatsoever. He was at 1%, you know, in 2012, which was pretty good. It was the best, results that the Libertarian Party had gotten in decades. And now he's at 5-6%, and he might even qualify for federal funding or taxpayer, you know, voluntary taxpayer dollars going to matching funds, which will ignite a huge I mean, this is going to be like the war between the mustache Pete's in old New York. It will destroy the mafia, you know, because the libertarian some will be, no, we take the money, and others will say we don't. And, you know, that'll take the next 20 years. But Andy, you work, I mean, we've been talking about this. You work at the Weekly Standard. Catherine, you work there for a spell as well. Now, let's talk about other people who had buffoonish moments. Bill Kristol, William Kristol, the editor-in-chief, the grand poobah of the Weekly Standard, also kind of soiled himself. And push back on this. I want to, you know, really kind of troll Bill Kristol on this, who is a phenomenal Twitter phenomenon or presence, and I think everybody should follow him on Twitter. He's almost up there. You know, he's getting into the Hall of Fame of Twitter trolls. He's kind of really great at that. But he flirted with Donald Trump for a while. And then when he said, okay, no, that's not going anywhere. And then he pushed the vaporware that was David French, a National Review writer with absolutely no, you know, qualifications to be president, who turned him down. And he teased, what was that, over Memorial Day or Labor Day weekend, where he's like, hey, I've got a really important thing coming about a third party, an independent candidate is going to do well. You know, for Andy first, because you actually work there, you know, what lessons does Weekly Standard...
Jesus Christ, what a setup is that? You're talking about my boss and one of my best friends, and you're saying... So, well, Andy, is he a moron or just an idiot? Is that what you're... Let me...
Feel free to answer the questions you raised. You know, I'm you know, like the 9/11 Commission, I'm just asking questions here. I'm not sure what really is going on, but
it's what people are saying. Yeah.
What does Weekly Standard conservatism and Republicans in general, you know, what do they need to learn from this campaign season? You know, is there a clear takeaway? And then Catherine, from a perch, obviously at Reason, which is very distinct from the Weekly Standard, but there's a fair amount of overlap. I mean, you know, Andy, you call yourself a libertarian right winger or a right wing libertarian. And there's a lot of people at the Weekly Standard. This part of the world, there's a lot of intermarriage, so to speak. But what does Weekly Standard conservatism or republicanism learn from this election season, if any? Are there big lessons?
I think the real lesson is finally people are realizing that the premise of questions like that is basically wrong. I wouldn't know how to begin to define Weekly Standard conservatism based on the views of all of my colleagues. I mean, it's just too heterogeneous a group of people. And it's the same with republicanism. I don't know what an ism would be about a party that, you know, that has Wall Street financiers and, you know, guys who own hardware stores and stay-at-home moms with kids who are homeschooling them and stuff. I don't know what that is there.
And David Duke, right? Isn't David Duke now?
Apparently.
He is running the Southern District of the Republican Party.
Yeah, so, did that back in the 90s.
Too. Are we done then with these? Obviously, national parties, we've always had two major parties at various points. What they stand for, what they change, you know, it can evolve or totally flip and stuff like that. But have we gotten to a point where the Democratic Party is also, you know, it's kind of fascinating when you look at how far Bernie Sanders got. And, you know, nobody was calling that the Democratic Party catechism. I mean, he's not even a Democrat. He's an independent. And yet he was able to take over a huge chunk of the Democratic Party's, kind of platform in this past election season. So is it just that these parties have, they need a new broader umbrella ideology or grouping, or do certain people have to leave the Republican Party and go elsewhere and new people have to come in? Is there anything meaningful to say about this election from that point of view?
Well, that's going to become an organizational problem, you know, and I just assume that all that stuff shakes out. Some people are going to be so disgusted by a large part of the party's rejection of Trump that they're going to say, you know, fuck these Republicans. They're all a bunch of rich guys. I don't want to have anything to do with them. Other people will be disgusted by the party because so many party leaders embraced him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing is, if these parties mean anything, it's that they are opposed to something. That's always, that's sort of a lesson I take from American history. Great movements arise in opposition to something. And when Hillary Clinton has the Democratic Senate and is in the White House and has Elizabeth Warren as Secretary of the Treasury or whatever, or Chairman of the Fed, believe me, the Republican Party will become a very unified, coherent political force, just as the way the rise of the Democrats in 2006 was purely, it wasn't because there was a great Democratic agenda, it was just because Bush was so incompetent, so.
Catherine, what do you see? Will there be an interesting conversation about what parties stand for and what kind of agendas they might put forward in a positive sense, rather than just saying no to whatever the other person wants?
You know, I was thinking the other day that I sort of hope in politics we can take a page out of the millennials and all their new genders that they have, right? Like, for a long time, we were like, okay, there's men and women. And now it's like, you're a gender fluid two-spirit who's a cis boy or whatever. I think it would be better if politics was like that. Like, if everybody got to make up their own labels and, like, fight about them to the death on Tumblr about, like, all the different shades of gray. And but that in the end, everybody with a weird made-up label also felt like they were on the same team. Right. If everybody said, like, listen, the two mainstream options are not for me, I'm going to be incredibly persnickety about how I describe myself, but make common cause with all the people who want to blow up the two major options. That would actually be a great outcome. And if we, you know, if it means we have to build some extra bathrooms, so be it.
Well, you know what? That might be the ultimate stimulus project. We've tried infrastructure. We've tried quantitative easing. Why not just build more bathrooms? And I'm old enough to remember, and Andy, you're probably old enough to have forgotten this, but when you would see on college campuses, if your college had a ceramics engineering program, the people in it would say, we set the American standard. There was a time when, you know, people bought American toilets, and that doesn't happen anymore, but maybe that's...
And you know what? More than that, they used them.
Yeah, we're all like North Koreans now. We, you know, we're like the Jong-un family. We don't, you know, nobody needs to go to the bathroom anymore. Let's blessedly leave politics behind for at least a few minutes and talk about the new issue of Reason Magazine and also, Andy, a piece that you did recently for Commentary that I think is great about Tom Wolfe. But let's talk about the new issue of Reason Magazine that Catherine has just put out. It's the December issue. Catherine, you've got a great piece, a provocative lead piece titled Free Speech Gave Us Trump, but Restrictions on Free Speech Will Give Us Something Worse. What are you getting at in that? And especially, you know, I mean, there's Trump and Hillary kind of appear in that. But what are you getting at with this idea of, you know, free speech gave us Trump? And you know what? That's better than the alternative.
Yeah, I actually think that. And maybe I'm just sort of a generically cheerful person, but I sometimes have a genuine feeling of joy about the American system when Trump says these horrific things and everyone's like, ugh, that guy is the worst. And no one ever says, let's go put that guy in jail. And that's you know, it sort of seems like a straw man, but Christopher Carlisle in an October issue of the Weekly Standard had an amazing discussion of a person who is probably maybe a little more like Frances Ann Coulter than Frances Trump, but a sort of anti-Islam polemicist who says stuff like Islam is incompatible with France, who is spending his time in court trying to defend himself and defend his words and defend his own freedom. You see this in Canada. Mm-hmm. You see it, you know, in the Netherlands, where, you know, promising to change the laws to have fewer Moroccan immigrants gets Geert Wilders pulled up on the dock. So, you know, it's not. No one likes to hear hate speech. No one likes to hear hateful speech, since I think hate speech is a sort of weird fake category anyway. But I'm proud of us for still not giving in to the temptation to lock that guy up.
Do you worry at all? And, you know, in that piece, what's really funny is when you're talking about the French guy, and you set it up brilliantly where it's like, you know, and then there's this guy in France who's just said these horribly hateful things that he's going to jail for or might go to jail for. And it really is like Islam is incompatible with a kind of modern liberal idea of free speech or a secular society. It's not, he's not, you know, he's not in, you know, calling for the mass slaughter in the streets of Paris or making the Seine, you know, foam with the blood of Algerians or anything. Do you worry at all that, you know, and obviously we cover this a lot at Reason. I know the Weekly Standard does, and everybody is, you know, the weirdness on college campuses where there's a lot of activism. Do you worry at all about actual restrictions on speech content?
I do, from the perspective that I think the thing that's happening on college campuses right now that's new, that's different than the version of this that we had in the 90s with political correctness, is that they've started using the word safety, right? That students are conflating, I feel sad about what you just said to me, and I am unsafe. And that's probably, if there's a place to drive a wedge, if there's a place to get in into the gaps in our free speech protections, it's there. So I do worry about a generation of students who genuinely believe that hearing something they don't want to hear makes them physically unsafe. But I am hopeful that that actually is a pretty small subset of college activists who will graduate and get a job and forget all about it.
Andy, you just ushered both of your children through college, and a few years ago you wrote a phenomenal book about trying to get your good-for-nothing older child into college called Crazy You, and the subtitle was something like One Father's Desperate Search to Get His Kid into a College, which you were overstating both the depths of your son's sloth and difficulty in getting into a grade school. He ended up going to UVA, which, you know, is in the news lately because it seems to be a very welcoming party school. But, you know, do you, I mean, as a parent, as somebody who just, you know, spent, you know, what, $6 or $7 million to send your kids to college, do you, I mean, and as somebody, when did you graduate college, Andy?
78.
Okay, so that is kind of the high point of the count, you know, of the reformation of college from an old in loco parentis and a kind of like, you know, John Houseman, you know, yelling at students that they have to, you know, hand their assignments in on time or they'll get an F and all that kind of stuff too. I mean, that was you were in the temporary autonomous zone of college.
Yeah, we had mandatory orgies actually
in the chapel. Right. But I mean, do you worry about the trajectory of free speech? And, you know, and sometimes it's hate speech. And I think Catherine is totally right that it's, you know, oh, I feel unsafe, so you have to shut the fuck up. That's a real problem. But then there are other things of saying, oh, well, you know, this is corporate speech and that doesn't get the same protection as personal speech. Hillary Clinton in particular is terrible on specifically political speech. You know, she's saying like a documentary that attacks me as a candidate should be against the law, you know.
Right.
But I mean, are you worried at all about the free speech dimension in America?
What bothers me, I mean, Catherine's exactly right. And as sort of a believer in American exceptionalism, I mean, I agree completely. It's what you look at what's happening in Europe and then you just think, oh, man, am I glad I'm American because we don't do stuff like that. My worry about this stuff about safe and unsafe is specifically the kinds of things that people say make them unsafe. What I'm astonished by when I talk to people either fresh out of college or still there is the inability to think about the world in anything but terms of ethnicity and race and gender. It's like, especially among the smarter kids I talk to, it's like this is this prism or this imprint or something is the only way that they can absorb reality and make sense of reality. And therefore, when someone says something that's outside those categories or doesn't even accept those categories as particularly important, then they feel unsafe. So it's not, to me, it's not just a matter of suppressing the speech, it's the grounds on which they want to suppress the speech, which seems to be just a kind of a full court press by higher education to make people feel this way and think this way. And that's sort of what bugs me.
Do you feel like your kids came out of college, did they buy into that, or were they hardened against that idea that race, class, and gender are the prisms through which everything needs to be approached? And, that's it. Or did it actually kind of also give them an awareness of, the ways that those things actually impinge on people's perceptions and understanding of the world and options in the world in a positive way?
Yeah, well, they both reacted differently and the same. I mean, they were instilled, I'd like to think, anyway, instilled with a good enough bullshit detector that they were able to resist some of that. But it still does become a habit of mind, you know. I mean, it becomes, if you do this for 4 years, and if your professors talk like this for 4 years, and then if your friends talk like this for 4 years, it does become sort of second nature. And so that's still there, even in people as virtuous and perfect as my children.
Yeah, sure. Obviously, you haven't been reading the rate my students, that, there's the whole rate my professors thing, but the professors are talking back finally. I will just add to that, my younger son, who's a sophomore in high school, he was talking about, and he goes to school in a university town, so they have a lot of student teachers who, they're not even credentialed yet, but they are very, excited about these new kind of categories. And in an American history class, they had a discussion about the cultural appropriation of dreadlocks by Justin Bieber a few years ago. For about 15 minutes, Justin Bieber wore dreadlocks. And what I was heartened by from the conversation, at least as my son was talking about it, he said, clearly the teacher didn't know that much about Justin Bieber and how he came to notice and who he works with. He was basically discovered and promoted by Usher, an African-American producer and rapper and a musician, a pop musician. And he hangs out with Dr. Dre. He's worked with all of the top black rap stars. And so a bunch of the students were like, but wait, maybe he was doing it as an homage to the people who helped him become who he is. Isn't that good? And then somebody else was like, well, I read that the Vikings had dreadlocks, that it's not just the black thing anyway. And it was kind of, I always love, and this is what I love about the age of social media, when authorities put something out as a pronouncement. If you go on Twitter or on an article anywhere, like when, somebody like David Remnick at The New Yorker makes some grand pronouncement, or Hendrik Hertzberg is one of the worst of these types of old school authorities, the first 20 comments are always like, fuck you, buddy, or like, get a grip. And that's happening. I hope that's happening in our classrooms in a positive way, not just in a kind of nihilistic screw you teacher. But
so they're saying fuck you in a positive, life affirming kind of way.
Well, no, but saying, cultural appropriation, first off, yeah, it exists. All culture is appropriated. And, maybe it's not a bad thing. And what you're saying, we should appreciate other cultures, but we should never, ever incorporate some of their practices into our lives, because that's unfair. That's what I'm saying, that I think, I'm a big believer in the kids. And I think this is, for me, the genius of programs like you talked about the bullshit detector, Andy, and your kids. And Catherine, I think your kids are a little young for this type of stuff. But, something like South Park has provided an incredible education, not for a specific set of beliefs, but for bullshit detecting.
Yeah,
I will say, actually, even my kids, who, my 5-year-old, she asks me your standard 5-year-old, like, why is the sky blue type questions. Mm-hmm. But she's like, Mom, just ask Google. She's like, you're just going to make some shit up. And it would be better if we got a real answer on this. You see these surveys that say one of the biggest shifts when they do these kind of longitudinal opinion surveys among students is that the students no longer say that they consider their teachers authoritative on matters of fact, right? So there's still the broader question of, well, is cultural appropriation a thing we should care about? But when it comes to, okay, but now we need some real information, even five-year-olds know better than to trust humans when computers are going to do a much better job. And I think that's actually totally liberating.
Yeah, I agree with that. And speaking of somebody who is, I think, a real agent of liberation, is Tom Wolfe, who Andy, in your review of his latest book, The Kingdom of Speech, in Commentary Magazine, you refer to him as America's greatest living essayist. Why do you think he's America's greatest living essayist? And you know, what do you zero in on the response to The Kingdom of Speech that you find particularly illuminating about problems with contemporary American intellectual discourse?
Well, he's there's lots of reasons why I would say that about him. He's just in terms of literary style, he's incredibly vivid, and even at the age of 86, these sentences and paragraphs just pump along like pistons. You know, you wonder what well he's bringing all that energy out of. It really is incredibly impressive, and it's always been arresting to me.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say, just on as a sheer stylist, he's probably more influential, starting from the mid 60s when he really kind of started writing books, et cetera. Probably the single most influential stylist in American letters, fiction, nonfiction, you name it.
Yeah, he single-handedly revived the exclamation point, I think. but this new book that he has is sort of a close parallel to two of his books that are my favorites of his books, these real short essays, one about modern architecture and one about modern painting.
So, and that's from Bauhaus to Our House and the Painted
Word. Yeah, that
was
the architect one, and then the Painted Word was the one about painting, in which he kind of he looked at these phenomena of modern architecture and modern painting in now sort of modern scientistic neo-Darwinian establishment, and said, there's a lot going on here that somebody should ask about, instead of just sort of having it served up to us from the gods on high and said, oh yeah, you really like this hideous Bauhaus structure, and it's really actually a beautiful piece of architecture. When everybody says, well, wait a minute, that, no, it's not. And Wolf actually he's sort of like a tribune of common sense. You know, he's sort of the advocate for that instinctual response. Is, no, this is really ugly shit, and I know it, and you know it, and let's cut the crap. And he's doing this now as Darwin and the theory of natural selection, the evolution through natural selection, has been used more and more to describe more and more human phenomena, especially from everything from morals to metaphysics and so on. Everything is evolutionary adaptation. He's kind of standing up and saying, now wait a minute, is this actually true? I mean, can you really stretch the theory of evolution, which through natural selection, which is pretty well established, can you really stretch it into the sort of interior life and psychological life and spiritual life of human beings?
And in The Kingdom of Speech, he's talking specifically about the way that various evolutionary psychologists, linguists and whatnot, talk about why speech exists.
Yeah, and as a way of saying, sort of undercutting the idea that there's anything particularly exceptional to about human life, mm-hmm. as opposed to just regular animal life. And I think he understands the full subversive potential of that idea, and so he's sort of saying, well, wait a minute, how are they really explaining all these human phenomena? Is it really plausible what they're saying? And it's not that he's trying to deny evolution of the natural world at all, I don't think. Instead, he's just kind of found another bunch of bullies, like the people who were making us like modernist architecture and making us like modern painting, and just saying, no, wait a minute, this isn't quite right. And of course, he does it with his usual panache, to use a word I don't know what it means. But anyway,
I think it's a type of sandwich. Panache. I'm not sure. But, well, you know, you one of the things that's great in the essay and commentary, it's online, and I really, you know, I without being totally unctuous here, you know, Tom Wolfe, I agree with you completely that he is one of the great essayists and reporters of our time,
yeah.
As well as novelists. You know, he's just really way up there. I think you are too, and I recommend people read this in commentary. in your piece, you talk about like the scientist response to Tom Wolfe and kind of putting him down, and then you also talk about scientists as being as fundamentalist, basically, as the guys in Times Square who are wearing sandwich board signs telling people the rapture's coming. Talk a little bit about that, because at least going back to the early 60s when C.P. Snow talked about the two cultures of the humanities and science drifting apart and they need more talk. We are getting, you know, we've been in this struggle, and you're right that the kind of neo-Darwinian explanation of like everything that I like in the world is that way because I believe in evolution, and evolution has decreed that, you know, the Golden Girls is the greatest goddamn TV show of all time, and we're actually, you know, we're attuned by evolution to laugh at B. Arthur or whatever. I mean, it just goes on and on. Everything is a series of just-so stories, which is both absurd, but then it's also clear that evolution has massive explanatory power for how the world is. So, you know, why are scientists, how are they fundamentalists, and how are they kind of the flip side of the, of the people who believe in God, as idiots? How are they kind of related to one another?
Well, you see it in the reaction to this book, which has been just outrage among the community that he's talking about, which was the same reaction he got from the modern architects, mm-hmm. and the critics of modern painting, of modern art. It's sort of like, you know, back off, journalism boy. You know, you don't know this is our territory, okay? You're in way over your head. You don't understand what's going on. I'd like to explain it to you, and I'll try, but chances are you aren't going to understand. And it's a way of, it's a kind of fascistic intellectual move, actually. And so everybody is supposed to be thrown back by this aura of expertise and this assertion of intellectual superiority, and Wolf just doesn't think that's bullshit, and he thinks that if something is true, it's accessible, and so he just sort of goes boldly forth, and they start throwing things at him, you know, because he doesn't understand, or he generalizes too much. One thing in particular, I think, is that's sort of unfair is you can't ask a guy to write about very complicated matters for a general audience and not kind of generalize and not explain every detail. I think it's important for the journalist to understand all the details. But, you know, you're going to kill your reader if you try and get them at the level of the way scientists talk. That's why scientific papers are unreadable, you know?
Well, and this is... in the popular conversation, this is why these scientists want to use the argument from authority, right?
Right.
So, like,
right.
When Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye make exactly the same type of generalizations, they're essentially saying, oh, well, I'm allowed to do it because, trust me, I'm an authority.
Right. Right.
I play a scientist on TV. I wish they would wear the lab coats that the people in the Milgram shock experiments did, you know, just as markers of authority.
I think the bow tie in Bill Nye's case is sort of a stand-in for the...
Catherine, do you read Wolfe at all, or do you have an appreciation for him, or is there somebody else in your kind of pantheon of... again, I mean, he's a fascinating character because he started out he got a PhD, I think, in American Studies at Yale. He worked at the Herald Tribune as a beat reporter. Then he became a writer, a kind of sociological journalist who went out and hung out with people and, you know, just reported on the craziness and the greatness and the proliferation of all kinds of weird shit in 60s and 70s America. But is Wolfe, does he figure in your universe, or is there somebody analogous to him that you follow?
True story. I once rode in a golf cart with Tom Wolfe for a while. He had come to Yale's tercentennial celebration.
And tercentennial, what is that? That's it was 150?
The 300th anniversary of Yale. And he was on stage immediately after Bill Buckley and Big Bird performed together.
Wait. Big Bird was, I thought Yale didn't allow birds until like 1980 or something.
Yeah.
That's cultural appropriation.
Yeah. What bathroom did Big Bird use on campus?
The mind boggles, really.
Did Bill Buckley have any, did he think it was Gore Vidal and he threatened to punch Big Bird in the nose and that he'll stay socked, I'll sock you in the nose?
No, I think it was the synonyms or words that start with B. I can't remember. I was participating in this event, and Tom Wolfe was meant to be on stage with Eli Yale, the sort of semi-founder of Yale. The whole thing was totally ridiculous.
Wait, so it was like an actor playing Eli Yale?
Yes, it was the head of the drama school playing Eli Yale.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Every single thing about this was demeaning to every single person.
Yeah. You know, it's demeaning to me listening to it, so I can only imagine what it was like to be there.
I feel violated.
Me and Tom Wolfe are basically best friends because of that one time in the golf cart. But, no, I'm a big fan. And anyone who writes about space, the right stuff – looms over every single word you write. There is no way to outdo that as a text. I also read I Am Charlotte Simmons and hated it with the passion of a quasi-millennial. But I think Tom Wolfe is a great example, and I think what you're describing, Andy, resonates with this. He's a great example of someone whose incredibly massive ego and total confidence in his own intelligence is a force for good. Right. Normally, it's a guy like that at a party and you're like, oh, I get it. You know, this is he's the kind of person who originates the term mansplaining. Right. Because he knows better than you what you know. But he sometimes his hit rate is high enough that he's worth it, essentially. And, you know, I love pop evolutionary psychology as much as the next gal in kind of a parlor game kind of a way. But it was a ripe target. And it sounds like he has taken it down a notch.
It's you know what, I agree with the mansplaining type of thing, and the closest interaction I had with Tom Wolfe was I saw him once standing on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue outside of the New York Public Library waiting to be recognized. He was wearing one of his stupid suits. And I was going to, you know, I watched him for about 10 or 15 minutes until he moved. But he was like standing. I think he had a walking cane or whatever. This would have been about 25 years ago. But you know what is also really great about him? And I think it's lost a lot when you merge him and Hunter Thompson and Joe Esterhaus and a couple of other kind of paragons of the new journalism. He took it really serious. Like, he learned things. Like, he doesn't spout off the top of his head. He hung out with Ken Kesey and the Murray Pranksters for a long time and, you know, and got to know them and then reported back what he found. He did that with, with the people in the Mercury program for the right stuff. And I remember reading, and I'm sure some of it is embellishment, but the research that he put in to write The Bonfire of the Vanities, which I think not the version, like he workshopped that in installments in Rolling Stone, and it was a genuinely uninteresting book. And then he rewrote it for the novel version, which is phenomenal. You look back on it now and you're like, oh, he was just describing the rise of people like Al Sharpton. He actually predicted the rise of Al Sharpton. All of the events in that book came out before Tawana Brawley. And it's, to me, as a journalist, as well as somebody very interested in fiction, he is doing the hard work of novels, of observing social customs, social manners, through the broad swath of class and all sorts of things going on. And it's built on research. And Catherine, it's funny when you mention I Am Charlotte Simmons, I think that was the book where he lost his touch. I don't think he knew what he was talking about.
That's the novel of a man who is about to send his daughter off to college.
Yeah.
And I think that
and
sort
also,
of overwhelmed his judgment in some ways.
Yeah.
Also, presumably a novel where he really, there was no way that he could do the research adequately, right? I mean, I really hope Because there's no way that he could sort of
He didn't put on like a freshman beanie with a propeller on it
Oh,
and
fellow
pretend
kid.
to
Yeah.
bunk in a dorm or anything. When I was in college, there was an anthropologist at Rutgers, Rutgers College in New Brunswick, who was doing that to learn like what student life was like. And if you ever went to the floor he lived on, it was always like people were either ignoring him completely or just feeding him full lines of bullshit. Because it's very, I mean, it's like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but with like a 40-year-old professor.
You know,
And
I'll say
you're,
w
yeah.
w one last thing about Wolf. He's 86,
Yeah.
so he can't really do that immersive reporting that he used to do. But what really impressed me about The Kingdom of Speech was it's almost the same kind of thing, except now it's just purely a matter of intellectual history. But I mean, he's really plunged into the archives and, obscure collections of letters of the early Darwinians, and he's read all the papers about Noam Chomsky, who's a major figure in the book,
And who
tracked
is
his
being
career very
disproven?
closely.
All of Chomsky's theories, as people actually do empirical work rather than just
Right,
kind of
right.
philosophizing from his third or fourth vacation home in Gstaad or wherever it is.
Right. So it's like he's doing the same kind of immersive reporting. It's just that it's all intellectual now, and it's in a way it's just as satisfying and really just impressive as hell.
Yeah. Okay, well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Andy Ferguson of the Weekly Standard and many other places. He's got a great piece on Tom Wolfe's latest book and the kind of Philistine response among scientists to it in commentary. Check that out. And of course, we've been talking with Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of the print magazine of Reason, who has a great piece in the new issue, the December issue, which will be out. I guess it's out to subscribers now, right, Catherine?
That's right.
Yes, and with more to come. Thanks so much for talking. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us, rate and review us at iTunes, check us out at SoundCloud, and go to reason.com and check out all of the stuff we're writing about, we're talking about, we're doing videos about. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nick.
And Catherine, thank you as well.
Sure thing.
All right. Thanks so much.